You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Community Connections, and being the second Wednesday of the month is our legal hour between 1 and 2 these days. And we have people in from Hutchinson Legal to tell us what bit about the law and discuss the law. And I have with me this afternoon Helen, who knows a bit about wills and disputes, and Sienna, who's a law student. So we're here to find out a bit about the universities, and we'll put Sienna under a bit of pressure and find out what's going on. No, I'm only kidding. First of all, we sent you away, or we sent the people away last time with to talk about scams. And the thing is, first of all, how can we pick a scam? If we got caught with a scam, if you've paid for that scam through a bank card, are the banks liable? Is it up to the banks to make sure it's a good, or what they think is good, or what? So over, I think, Sienna, you're going to tell us a bit about scams.
Yes, thank you, Alan. So the first question you were talking about was, is there legal recourse if someone is scammed?
That's right.
Perfect. So there's kind of two different ways that someone could be prosecuted. But the problem with prosecuting someone is often you don't know who the scammers are.
And often they're overseas.
Exactly, yeah. So there is provisions under the Australian Consumer Law about misleading and deceptive conduct. And then there's also a Commonwealth Act called the Criminal Code Amendment, which relates to theft, fraud, bribery and related offences. And yeah, so that's kind of an angle that we can take. But obviously the problem is that often you cannot find the scammers. And so then the courts, even though they can order different remedies against a scammer, it's highly unlikely that they'll actually be caught.
Can the courts, they can't make an order against, say, someone in Russia or something, can they? Like, the laws there our courts don't have any jurisdiction in those areas, do they?
I'm not 100% sure. I don't think so. But, yeah, we still, any scams that happen in Australia still should be reported to the Australian Cybersecurity Centre, which is an Australian government thing, and then, they will deal with it from there.
Then there's still more that you're going to talk about. What happens if you're paid with a scam on your bank card?
Yeah. So if the money has already been transferred to the scammer, it is mostly irrecoverable, unfortunately. So you have kind of a little window, very, very quick window, but once the money has left the bank, often it's really, really hard to get it back.
And I guess this is probably not a question for you, but I guess if a scammer's waiting for you to put some money in, it's going to hit their bank account or the bank account they've suggested, and probably 10 seconds later it's gone.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Sometimes the banks may refund the money if you can prove that reasonable precautions were taken and you actually were defrauded. This seems to be quite a high bar to prove, though. You have to be really reasonable in your precautions, and oftentimes we're not. just guarding your PINs, passwords, be careful with all your online transactions, checking your history, all that kind of thing can protect and be precautionary. But there's an example of overseas. The Development Bank of Singapore actually warns its customers not to transfer money to unknown people or accounts without careful thought, and they do this by requiring an extra kind of step in the process just to make sure that you authorise if you don't know the account.
Yeah, I had heard that, but yeah. Is that available in Australia as well, or is it only just overseas?
From what I can tell, it's just this specific Bank of Singapore at the moment, but I haven't seen, I don't know. Hopefully we can bring it in over here. That would be helpful. And then in terms of how to know if it's an illegal scam, there's a few ways. obviously the first thing you should do, even if you're not 100% sure, is you should immediately contact your bank and the police. The bank can shut down your card from there. And sometimes if it's a common scam, they will already know that that's circulating. So they'll say, oh, this is similar facts, and say, yeah, this is a scam. There's also a website called ScamWatch online, which has a huge amount of resources on different types of scams. So you can see if you've been targeted by any of them. And then it also provides really helpful advice in the best ways to report that scam. So that's really helpful if you think that you might have been targeted. And then your last question, Alan, I think was about how to legally protect yourself from scams. Yeah. So similar to what we were saying before about the precautions, you have to be really strict with any transfers, payments, storing of passwords. I know a common one is storing your passwords on your phone, and apparently that is really unsafe to do.
And some people have passwords of ABC and 123.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not going to take long to get them out.
No, so you have to be really careful with that. And then, yeah, just safeguarding your personal and professional identity, because there's a lot of identity theft going around. So there's different resources on the Australian Police website, different ASIC websites and things like that to protect yourself and your passwords and all those accounts.
Too many people put too much up on Facebook,
yeah,
and all of a sudden you can almost create a person off that.
That's exactly right, Alan.
All right, got to take a quick break and we'll be back with more.
Yeah. 99.1.
You're listening to Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
And hello, Grant, if you happen to be listening or if you listen to this podcast, I'll try and catch up with you before Christmas. I'm talking to Helen Sienna from Hutchinson Legal. And we're now going to move on to wills, and these things can be terribly contested. But so let's talk a little bit about it, Helen. How, first of all, you can try and not have your will contested, and secondly, how many people can? I know they've cut back on the sorts of people that can. Tell us a bit about it, please.
Yeah, thanks, Alan. In terms of how to prevent people contesting your will, a wonderful way is actually to have a will and to get good legal advice in terms of drafting a will. I'm biased, I know, Alan, but I got to say that. There are lots of ways where you can actually really strategically plan around someone's estate, someone's circumstances when it comes to potential disputes and how to minimise them. So, yeah, I would definitely recommend talking to a lawyer you trust when it comes to that.
So who can contest?
Yeah. Yeah, so what you mentioned before, Alan, is true, that it used to be really anyone could contest a will. Now they've narrowed it down to what the court calls eligible people. Oftentimes, that's what you think of when it comes to spouses, partners, children, the obvious, but also extends to stepchildren sometimes, extends to other members of the household sometimes as well.
Could I just ask you, are stepchildren on the same category as children, or is the children at a higher level than stepchildren, or are they the same?
Yeah, you're not going to like this answer, Alan. It depends. Yeah, that's the issue with this area of law, though, is that the court has a really broad jurisdiction when it comes to definitions sometimes and what they're looking for, and they'll take each case on its merits, really, and each situation is different. Every family is different, so, yeah.
All right, so how can you... I know apart from the fact that you say get a good lawyer, but how can a person sort of minimise the disputes that are going to come out of a will?
Yeah, that's a good question, Alan. There's a few ways, generally. Generally, sometimes there are certain things that actually don't form part of an estate. Superannuation doesn't generally form part of the estate. Joint assets doesn't generally form part of the estate. Anything that you actually want to give away during your lifetime is a great and handy tip and a handy way to dispose of yourself.
But you can only give a certain amount of money every year, can't you?
Well, yes. It depends on what kind of... if you're on a pension, what kind of income you're on. There are certain things that will affect that. If we do meet with someone and they have concerns about a child or a situation they're in, and they do want to kind of strategically work around that, then we can ask them certain questions and find out more. Yeah.
Well, all right. So I've got a couple of brothers, we'll say, and mum and dad are getting a bit old. My mum or dad's passed on. There's only one left, so I know when the next one pops off, the will or what all the assets will come my way, but I think I want more than anybody else. So I put a caveat on their property. So the person dies, is that legal? And how would you get around that?
About the caveat, Alan?
Yeah.
Ooh, okay, that's a good question. I'm not a property lawyer, unfortunately, Alan. Oh. You've opened a can of worms.
Have I?
That's all right. But in terms of if mum and dad, or if you said, I think dad
died, one passed,
yeah.
And the
survivor.
Because generally the will is husband to wife or wife to husband.
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden now there's only one left. That person's going to die, but I think I should get more.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, that'd be for your surviving parent to decide.
Parent's gone. The second parent is gone as well. The second parent's now gone.
Oh, okay. Yes. Okay, so you'd like to make a claim in this hypothetical scenario, Alan.
Yeah, I'd like to.
I understand.
I've got two brothers, and I say, no, but blow you. I think I deserve more than the rest of you.
Okay, sure. Yes.
So
I'll
put a caveat on the property so it can't be solved.
Yes.
How does it go? What happens then?
Yeah. Well, caveat aside, it'd be good to see a lawyer. And a lawyer, like I said, that you trust and who's knowledgeable in this area, it's actually quite a small niche area sometimes. And so having someone who's got experience in this area is a critical or a good thing to look for. Knowing, and so, yeah, they would know then the next kind of steps in terms of bringing a claim, if you wanted to bring a claim. The first thing would be kind of getting you advice as to whether or not you should make a claim.
Is it likely to happen? Like, are they more likely to say that the three of you will just get an equal share and forget about what you say? I understand if one of the child is disabled, then that's a little bit different, but we'll say that's not in this case. So are they likely to just to say, nope, three of you get the same, or are they going to really take it seriously, and why would they give me more than the other two?
Yeah, that's good questions, Alan. Like I said, it depends, unfortunately. There's lots of factors, actually, the court looks at. The court looks at, really, some, for instance, the size of the estate, how much money there's in the estate. They look at the financial needs of yourself, the financial needs of your brothers, your hypothetical brothers, for instance. Those are just some things they look for. Whether or not one factor is more important than the other, really, there's no answer to that. It's the culmination of the factors. It's what the court on... the judge that you get on the day potentially might decide. So it's all unknown, actually, unfortunately.
So once you get in, what you're really saying, am I right, that once you get into the legal side of it, it can go anywhere?
Yeah, it really can, yes. Yeah, and hopefully with a good lawyer, you'll get an idea of what it might end up as, whether or not you might be successful or not, what your outcomes might be. So, yeah, a good lawyer will tell you that. But, yeah, like anything that comes through, you know, the court system, it's hard to sometimes guess.
And the other thing is too, is it right that the estate has to pay the legal costs, so that I could be, if I really got annoyed with my two hypothetical brothers, that I could actually go to court and just waste money so that I'm bringing down the pool so they don't get as much?
Yeah, so usually if you have your claimant, an eligible person, and you have what the court might consider an actual claim, you have merit, then yes, the state usually pays the costs, but that's not every situation and that's not every case. So if you want to deliberately just make a claim to waste the state's resources, then that might go badly for you, Alan. I wouldn't recommend it.
All right, let's take a break and we'll come back with more.
services, local events. Yarra Valley FM, 99.1, the voice of the valley.
You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Helen, we want to talk about the forfeiture rule. I thought the forfeiture rule means you gave things up, but you're going to tell me you are giving something up, but a right, isn't it?
Yeah, so generally speaking, it's an interesting thing that the law has, where if you kill someone, if you're charged with their murder, then you are no longer entitled to any part or share of their estate. So you're forfeited, like your rights to that estate are forfeited. So
if it was a husband and wife, and we'll say they've got three children, if one did the other one in, so the whole estate would go to those children?
Yes, potentially, if the husband's, or whoever the victim was, if their will stated that everything went to, the wife, and then if she died, then the children, well, then you'd kind of disqualify the wife from that, and then everything would go to the children. Not always speaking, but generally speaking, that's probably what it would look like. But there are, it's just interesting, and it's a wonderful thing. I think that's what people would assume is fair, and the law isn't always fair, like with contesting wills, like we talked about before, it's not always fair outcomes, but this does seem fair that if you kill someone,
if I remember rightly, there was a case down in Malvern years ago where a guy killed his mother and father, a very rich family. I think he's still in jail now.
I vaguely do remember that.
Walsh or something, anyway. So he would have automatically cut himself out of his family's will.
That's correct, if he was found guilty of their...
This case that I'm talking about.
Yes.
He went to jail. I presume he's still in jail.
He would have forfeited himself from any share of that estate.
Pretty good reason, because you don't want to kill your parents.
Yes, you don't, no. It does reduce the incentive of if you ever want to kill your parents, which no one should. Of doing that. But there are... sad situations as well. So there is a case where a wife had been a victim of domestic violence from her husband ended up killing him, and she wasn't actually allowed any share of his estate because she was charged with his murder. So there are exceptions to the forfeiture rule.
So when you say but you didn't say that was the exception. So
no, unfortunately, with this case... No, unfortunately, in that case, she wasn't the exception. But there are, I think, two exceptions. And they're mental illness, if you are mentally unwell, if you're found guilty, not guilty by reason of mental illness, and where the will benefits the killer, where the will benefiting the killer, is made after the actual criminal act. So I'm not sure in the circumstances like that, but
that'd be pretty hard, because the person making the will would be dead.
Yes, exactly, unless you tried to kill someone, and then after the attempt, you still wanted them to be part of the will, so who knows?
Imagine that. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We want to talk to Sienna because she's a law student at the moment. I think you're in what year, Sienna?
I'm in my third year.
Out of how long?
Out of 5 years at Deakin,
Right, so we're going to talk to Sienna all about legal training. We're back in a couple of minutes.
listening to Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Now, Sienna, you told us that you're a lawyer, a law student, should I say, obviously at uni at the moment, and
yes.
You've just completed year 3 out of 5. You've got 2 more to go. So tell us a bit about the life of a student and what's available to you. And we know you're on work placement at the moment, but, like, how obviously it's intense, of course, but are you there 5 days a week or 3 days a week or... And all day or what?
Yeah, great questions. So it definitely does depend on the units and the timetabling that you choose to do. So
Talk about yours.
Yeah, sure. So last trimester I was in about 3 days, 3 full-ish days with classes. Yeah, but then the good thing about... Deakin is that there are online recordings of a lot of the classes. So the classes are recorded often, but the seminars aren't. So
you have to make sure in the
seminars. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it definitely depends on the load, the amount of units you're doing. The law units usually have 2 to 3 hour lecture plus a 2 hour seminar each week. And then some of the elective ones might be a bit shorter than that, and some of the law units might, rather than having a in-person lecture, might all be online content, which takes a lot longer because you have hours and hours of videos to do each week. So that takes way longer. I prefer having an in-person class.
So how often would you be at uni in a normal week?
Yeah, so I'm there usually 3 days. And so that works well.
And so sort of what hours are you at uni?
So often if I go in, it's a while drive for me, so I stay there for a while. I'll do some studying in between classes and catch up with some friends and do that kind of thing. But so I usually am there all day, for about 3 days a week.
All right, so when you come out in another 2 years, what would you like to specialise in?
Oh, great question. Still figuring it out. There's so many options, wonderful options. I'm very interested in discrimination law, so religious freedom, human rights law, all those kind of areas where you can particularly fight for freedom and for justice.
Are you talking about in the workplace or just in general in society?
Definitely both. Yeah. So in general, but in the workplace, in society in general, it's a big broad range of places that discrimination can happen. But then again, I was talking to Helen and on this placement, this has been the first interaction I've ever had with wills and estates, that area of law. There's no unit at Deakin really about that, or it's not a core unit. So I've been learning a lot about wills and estates, and that's been so fascinating.
Is this your first placement that you've had, or have you had other placements along?
Yes, no, so this is my first one. So to become a lawyer, there's kind of 3 stages that you have to complete. Yep. The well-known one is obviously the degree.
Yep.
You might have heard of this. I had never heard of this phrase. When I got to uni, everyone was talking about the Priestly 11.
Priestly 11?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't know what that is. and pretty much it's 11 core law topic units that to become a lawyer and to have your law degree count, you need to cover all these 11 areas of law.
What sort of areas?
Yep, so they include contract law, criminal law, evidence, civil procedure, ethics, torts law, constitutional law, property, administrative law, equity and trust, and corporate law. They're the 11.
So you have to have had experience in all those through work placement or by getting a job at the end?
So your degree needs to cover them. So, you need to do those 11 units. Now, a lot of the unis actually split them up into even more specific areas underneath them. So say I don't have 11 core units to do. That would be a quick degree. So Deakin has split them up into even more of those topics. So I think we have maybe those 11 are split into about 16 or something units, right. Plus then we have the elective units. Now, one of those elective units, you have to do a placement. So you get that practical training, and that has been amazing. Honestly, I was starting to think, I don't know, law, you know, it's very dry. And then I did the placement, which I've absolutely loved, and it's just so different because you're working with clients, yep. And you're actually helping them and involved on the ground, and it's really reaffirmed my desire to do law. So I've absolutely loved the placement. So that's the degree part, and then after that there's two more things you have to do to actually become a lawyer. There's the practical legal training, PLT, which is about 4 to 6 months after you've done your degree, and that's
in a placement.
I think a lot of it is, yeah, yep. But yeah, you're just trained how to, you know, draft documents, you know, apply to court, all those kind of practical things that, yep. A lawyer needs to know. And then Helen will know more about all this because I haven't got to this part yet, but then you have to be found to be a fit and proper person for practice, because obviously lawyers need to be trustworthy. So I think you have to do police checks and disclose, you know, any encounters with the law that you've had. And then they check you through that. And then, yeah, that's the stages. Then you're there.
All right, we'll take a quick break and we'll be back with more.
Scrapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Helen, when you appoint an executor for your will, are they entitled to be paid, or is it a presumption that they shouldn't be paid?
Yeah, it's a good question, Alan. So generally speaking, the presumption is no, executors shouldn't be paid for the work they've done. It's considered an honour to be an executor, usually. And
not
usually,
sure everyone would agree with that.
Well, usually as well, executors are beneficiaries themselves. So if you appoint as your executor, your husband, your wife, your children, they're usually receiving a huge chunk of the estate to begin with.
The presumption was you shouldn't have someone like that, that you should have someone outside the family.
No, actually, Alan, yeah, good question. Or good presumption, I guess. But oftentimes, executors are appointed. The executors appointed are the family members who will receive. And that actually gives them incentive sometimes as well to actually wrap up the estate because they'll get the benefit as well. So
is there ever a time when the executor does get paid, other than if you put it into one of these public companies or one of these organisations that do it?
Yeah. So sometimes there are... exceptions to this presumption, and you have got to show that you've done above and beyond, really, what the normal scope of work would be required. If the will says that you're entitled to a commission, then you're entitled to commission. If all the beneficiaries agree as well that you're entitled to commission, you can receive a commission. Or you can apply to the court as well. And so each executor has the right to apply to the court. Doesn't mean they'll get a commission, but they're welcome to apply. Yeah.
And I guess it depends on how much time it takes. I mean, some are pretty easy, aren't they? It's either divided from the husband to wife, or wife to husband, or for the surviving spouse to the kids. And I guess there's not a lot to do with that, is there? Just lodge the papers and away you go.
Yeah, exactly. So, it's quite a high bar, and generally speaking, there's lots of factors, but you do have to show that you've experienced some sort of pain, trouble, above and beyond.
Time.
Yeah.
And I guess one of the things that people need to be careful of, and I nearly fell for this trap, is that I appointed somebody else in the family, but not my children.
Mm.
And then I realised that they were getting pretty old, and they could either not be able to do it, or B, they might conk out, and I didn't have an executor, so I've had to change mine.
That's a common scenario people find themselves in, Alan. Yeah, so we do say, look at your wills every 5 to 10 years, really, powers of attorney every 5 to 10 years too. Just the people you've appointed, what kind of situation are they in? Have they moved overseas, for instance? That's... that's a trigger. You probably should look at changing it. Are they getting older? Is their health okay? Things like that. Things like that can really encourage people.
All right, so have you got a bit of paper and pencil? We just want somebody to... We've had a few questions come up
It's
mainly one question, and it's very topical with Christmas coming up.
Mm-hmm.
They want to know the legal rights of returns of items purchased. Now, some stores take them back if the product is not fit for purpose, if there's something wrong with it, it was supposed to do A and it won't do it.
Yep.
Others say, well, no, we'll only give you a credit note. We want to know, is that legal? Can the person insist on their money back and not just a credit note? The third thing is, most stores say, we're not going to take things back just because you change your mind. Now, coming up with Christmas, you might get something that you can't use.
Mm.
Now, if you contact the person that gave it to you, I'm thinking more if a child gave, one of your kids gave you something and you said, look, I don't really need that. And they said, well, I bought it from, and I'm not going to use any names, I bought it from Joe Bloggs, but he's not going to take it back because of it, you don't want it. Do you have any legal right, or is it, can they just say, well, bit of bad luck, you haven't changed your mind because it's just you've been given something you can't do. So I guess we really want to have a good look at returns just in general. I know some of people, so there's one or two that will take them back no matter what. Doesn't matter whether you change your mind or what. They just, for customer service, if you don't want something anymore, they're happy to let you. But they're not all that, not every company is the same. So we want to know what the legal rights are, not what they should do.
Yeah.
Some of these cases, what they should do and could do, vary a terrible lot from what what legally you're allowed to do.
Yeah, great question, Alan. We'll get back to you on that one.
And I guess while you're looking at it too, the other thing I wouldn't mind you, which is all part of this, and that's these, I just can't think of the name, it's just escaped from me, where somebody gives you a card, you know, with $50 or $100.
Gift card.
Yeah, a gift card.
Yeah.
I couldn't think of that. What right, like, can the organisation put a time on and say if this is not cash within 12 months, bad luck, you lose the money?
Yeah.
Or what's the legal? Because some will say to you, no, you can cash it in over the next 5 years or whatever you like. But others will say to you, no, it's only right for 12 months.
Yeah.
Is that legal? Because I'm not sure whether that's legal or not. Because they've got money. And what right have they got to say, well, after a certain amount of time, it's bad luck?
Yeah, good questions, Alan. Yeah.
So maybe, particularly because there will be a lot of gift cards handed out at Christmas, because that's one of the biggest reasons why they're available is Christmas and birthdays. And unfortunately, I should mention here, and it can happen anywhere, that very often when they're handed out on Christmas Day and there's wrapping papers everywhere and all that sort of stuff, they often get bundled up and thrown out.
Yeah, sadly.
And you can't get another one because how does anyone know you got it?
That's true.
But that's not a legal question. That's just an observation. Yeah. With people coming out on Christmas Day, be very careful because I know people have thrown them out.
So if you
could have a look at that.
Sure,
because I think... We've had three or four questions, but that covers them all, really, what we can do.
Mm-hmm.
Just very briefly, class actions, what are they?
Class actions is a group proceeding that you can join if seven or more people have been affected.
It's got to be seven or more?
Yeah, has to be at least seven. Seven or more. If you've been affected by the same wrong or the same cause of action, so from the same or similar act of the wrongdoer. In Australia, you can have an opt-in or opt-out approach. That's the one that Australia has adopted. So what that means is for everyone, say it's a big issue that's affecting a whole lot of different people. I'm trying to think of one off the top of my head. I can't really think of one. But if you've all been affected by, say, a bad product or something and you've all been sick from it... all the people must have that same common cause of action, and you can either opt in or opt out. So you can apply and say, I don't actually want to be part of this, and then you can't...
Why would you not want to be part of it?
Yeah, well, some people just don't want to go through the stress or the pressure of being part of the proceeding or pay some of the costs. But then the problem with opting out is that you're not eligible to receive any of the compensation if the group wins. You just have to be careful with... If there's a class action... relevant to your circumstances, think about it carefully, because if it's a good one, you might get some compensation out of it, but just be careful of that opt-in opt-out approach.
Class actions normally only for sort of something that's really happened big.
Well, not necessarily, because you could have seven or eight people just bringing a class action. So it doesn't have to be a huge thing. It just, the requirements are that it just has to be, you know, a substantial issue, or you just need to have a common cause of action from the same or similar act of the wrongdoer. So if you have that, then yeah.
All right. Look, ladies, it's unfortunately my time has come. We've put in the hour. We've certainly got those few questions, particularly coming up about returns. But thank you for your time again.
Oh, thank you so much.
Hope you've enjoyed the hour with us, and we look forward to seeing someone from Hutchison Legal on the on the second Wednesday of December.
Thanks, Alan. Thank you so much, Alan.
It's been great having you along, and I hope both of you have a great Christmas, because we are getting very close to the Christmas period, aren't we?
Thank you. Yes. Have a great Christmas as well.